Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning. It is Thursday morning, the 28th of June. The sun is rising and the tomb of Jesus is empty. It means that he is risen. He is risen indeed. And that is good news, because regardless of what life throws at us, which can be hard, is that we always have hope and always have future. It doesn't take away from the travail of the present moment, but it does mean that there is another part of the story towards which we can turn our eyes. Our Savior lives and death has been beaten. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Logan Rausch. And Logan, we start the show with that phrase about the empty tomb each day, because it really is the meaningful part of the Christian journey, that there really is hope and future. And there's some troubling things even for my own family last night, where we went to feed our beloved cats. We have four of them in the garage. We got them. We have about an acre of property, and they are our vole hunters. I come, you know, the snow melts each spring, and of course I've got these crazy trails running through my beautiful yard, and I'm a little bit of an old man when it comes to the yard, right? The yard's got to be perfect at this moment. And so we bought the cats to eat the voles, and they've been doing this great job. And our oldest cat, Charlie, our male cat, he is our beloved cat. Well, he had congenital a heart defect, and so he was only 3 years old. He was the oldest of the four, and he passed away suddenly last night from that. And so I'm sure our listeners know just how brutal it is to lose a pet. It was just devastating for us last night as
for
a family.
Sure. Well, it's so hard to describe what bringing a pet into your family means. I mean, for the kids and even for you, they're just this source of constant love and affection. Not always with cats, but definitely. I'm so sorry. I know what that's like, especially for the kids to lose an animal that's so beloved to them.
Yeah, and the tears are sweet tears. They're difficult tears. But they're sweet in the sense that they're there because you also experience love. I mean, that's the great trick of this whole thing, right? You can sort of either turn off your heart to all things and to try to avoid the sorrow. But in doing so, then you can't just magically turn on to love. It's both sides of the same coin. And mm-hmm. pets are so beloved in our lives. And it brings up one of the questions that I think we often hear, and we even talked about it last night as a family a bit, which is the idea of seeing Charlie again and seeing Charlie in his new body, free of a heart defect, running around the meadows of heaven, probably actually playing with the voles instead of eating them at this point. But it does bring up the question, do pets go to heaven? It's a question we don't often talk about in churches and Sunday school.
I'm pretty sure there was a movie called All Dogs Go to Heaven, so I'm sorry
about
Charlie.
Which is shocking for me, actually. So, yes, okay.
That is a good question, and that's something that I think we'll have to dive into in our next topic, which is something called Super Sunday School, or we're calling, that we'll set up next, but it's an important topic.
And these are the questions of our faith that I find we just haven't necessarily talked very much about. So even as parents with our kids, they kind of stumble and stutter, recognizing that in God's beautiful heaven and kingdom, all things are being set right. And on that basis alone, we got to believe that Charlie is there and that his body is free from defect and that tomb is empty for the entire creation, because even the trees and the rocks are longing for their release. Things will be redeemed and restored at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
It is Faith Radio Mornings. We're just about 8 minutes past the hour. We'll take a short break and set up our new segment here on the morning show. It is 9 minutes past the hour, and that, of course, is the walk-up music that Bill Arnold, the previous host of the morning show, found for me when we come in. He really loved that one. He was able to, at the same time that he wrinkled his nose when he would say Dr. Peter Kapsner, because he couldn't believe that somebody like me would have a doctorate, we loved that opening song. So thanks for resurrecting that again, Logan. It's going to lead us into one of our new segments we're going to bring about in the morning show here.
Yeah, we're going to try something out. So it's called Super Sunday School, and it is going to to be based upon the questions that you might have for a teacher or leader, you know, something that you might be, Dr. Peter Kapsner.
Well, I don't know about that. What I do know is that in maybe 15 years of teaching in the classroom, that some of my favorite moments in class is when we just go completely off script and we just open up the hour and 40 minutes together with students being able to ask whatever question they want to ask about the faith. It could be about something in the Bible that makes no sense. It could be just troubling topics. And here's what I'm going to say. I can't claim that I'm going to be able to answer all the questions, so I will reserve the right to be able to play the I don't know card and maybe do some research in the next week and come back to it the following week. But it's been a fun segment because, you know, kids' Bibles growing up tends to be, what, the creation story, the Noah story, and then maybe a bit about Moses. We have something about a giant and a sling and a stone, and then all of a sudden we're at the Star of Bethlehem. And there's lots of stories in between. If it's all inspired, it all matters.
Exactly. And so what we're going to try to do is focus on these questions that adults would have and would want to explore further and take a dive into those in a session where we can essentially just ask questions and see what happens. So this is a segment we are fantastically dubbing
Super Sunday School.
So, Peter, we started off just in the last segment and asking the question, but I'd love to hear a quick recap of do pets go to heaven? I think that's a good softball to ask for, especially our kids, and definitely for parents to wonder about is, what do I tell my kid? You know, do pets go to heaven?
Well, I sure wish there was a passage in Ephesians somewhere that would say, you know, all pets go to heaven. But we don't have that from the biblical text. And actually, Logan, I was reading an article from one of our ongoing guests, Karen Swallow Pryor from Liberty. And she actually writes on this topic. And she points out in several occasions where it's quite clear that God has deep concern for animals, that it's even in Psalm 104 that it is his spirit that holds the animals together. And in the same way of human beings, they return to dust should he remove his spirit. So clearly, there is a care there for the animals as well. We know that not a swallow will drop without him knowing about it. So there is care for that. We have Noah's Ark in preserving the animal kingdom. C.S. Lewis writes about, in The Problem of Pain, the idea that at the very least, the tame animals that we love will be in heaven for us. So we do have quite a bit of precedent. We don't know for sure. But I think what we can say is that God demonstrates significant care and the love that we share for animals now, that at the very least, we're going to experience completeness and wholeness in heaven.
Yeah, that phrase of the fact that God loves all creation and all creatures of the earth. He has specifically elected us and the chosen nation of Israel as his beloved, made in his image. But as much as he loves us, it's not so much that he loves the animals less, but that they aren't, you know, us.
Absolutely. But so I think we can safely say we'll be reunited. And if not, we can also safely say that God wipes away all of our tears. So somehow there's going to be wholeness we can lean and trust in those moments.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good first softball.
That is. I'm really scared of where you're going next. And, you know, we'll eventually open up to listeners for this one, too. So I'm mildly terrified right now. Where are we headed, Logan?
Well, I want to ask you about, and I don't know the correct word, charismaticness, charismaticism.
Well, you're already on the road to being a theologian because theologians just make up stuff. So,
oh, okay.
So this is really helpful. Yeah. So charismaticness we'll go with.
Charismaticismness is what I'll call
perfect.
It. Perfect. I'm wondering about this because there's definitely parts of the Bible that describe the Spirit coming down, blessing people. For instance, I think of the many tongues being granted, allowing people to speak in all languages and being to speak to each other and saying, wow, what is this? I wonder about the charismatic idea because it's definitely something we see in the Bible, but it's also something we're kind of afraid to approach. I mean, no one wants to be the person that says, well, God told me to do this, but I don't really know if God told them to do that. That's such a tough thing we grapple with. So when I think of churches that are charismatic, why is that something we should be concerned about, and or is that something we should embrace?
Oh, wow. Can I plead the fifth on this one, Logan? Well, it's a great question, right? I remember in my systematic theology class that our prof was pointing out that the role of the Spirit is one, as opposed to God the Father and God the Son, one that's often viewed with suspicion and one that we can't be certain. And so even theology textbooks, if you were to go to school somewhere, tend to have a pretty extended section describing the realities of God the Father. And then they have massive sections describing the role of Jesus the Son. And then it's almost like this appendix or this very teeny section about the Spirit. And I don't think people really want to get into this because we've seen both the abuse of claiming that the spirit has inspired. We see the abuse in which people are told that you must speak in tongues in order to be part of the kingdom, and so they can make it up. Many of my students talk about experiences at camp, sitting around a campfire and waiting for the blessing of tongues. And if they don't receive it and their friends are maybe receiving it, they start feeling left out and kind of make it up. So you have that on one side. But on the other side, we don't want to throw away the baby with the bathwater, because the very seminal moment of Pentecost was that the Spirit arrived on all people. And that was one of the great prophetic promises of the Old Testament. Was the Spirit's very active in the Old Testament, but tends to be just among the leadership of Israel or in people like Samson, empowering and inspiring them to do things on behalf of the kingdom. But in the book of Joel, it talks about how the Spirit is going to be poured out on all people post the coming of the Messiah. And so the idea that the Spirit is not active would not hold up with the biblical text. And I think the question is how do we carefully discern? How do we carefully interact with the realities of the Spirit? Because if we're just sort of dealing with this whole thing on head knowledge alone, God's a very relational God, and Jesus promises that his Spirit will be with us. So I think at the very least, it's an incredibly important conversation to wonder, what is the role of the Spirit in our life, both in our internal transformation as well as empowerment for the kingdom?
Well, then a very easy question. How do I know that the Spirit is in me? What is it? My elbow, my left elbow starts itching, yeah. And I hear a ringing in my right ear. That's how I know, right?
Right, right. The audible voice question, right? You know, and I sure wish it was an audible voice, or that maybe the Archangel Michael would show up with a note on my front door saying that this is clearly a word from God. I mean, the still small voice, right? I think we have sort of internal impressions of which way to go. Historically in the church, they talk about these two fancy terms that are called consolation and desolation. And consolation is that sense of, if I start walking out the journey a certain direction, there's a peace with it. There is sort of this sense of, yeah, this is the right way to move. Whereas desolation is kind of that unexplained, I don't know what's coming, but I probably shouldn't walk that way. That's just one way the church has talked about discerning the Spirit. I think the caution is discerning the Spirit alone is really a problem, right? Because I don't know if it's the pizza I ate last night that's speaking to me sometimes or that. So to be in community and to have multiple voices looking at the same direction, that's historically how the church has done this. But we struggle sometimes in American culture where everything is individualized, and I have my personal relationship with Jesus, which again is not necessarily a biblical concept. It's more of an individualistically one. We're meant to live this out in community and relationship. And I think actually, Logan, a lot of millennials are looking just for that in the church, right? Instead of these individualized relationships of holiness, there's really a desire for family.
I actually recently attended a church for the first time to check out that sort of ideal. It was a very charismatic place. Everyone was standing, shouting, jumping together, something you'd traditionally only get in a Southern Baptist church, but everyone was 25 years old, like around me. And it was this energy and this incredible joy and community, and they were the pastor toward the end of the service would lift up his hand and say, I just want to pray for someone's left rotator cuff. Someone's left rotator cuff tonight.
I could use that right now, actually.
Is in need of healing. And I sat to myself and I said, this is what I hear to be concerned about, is people specifically saying, you know, you hear of televangelism.
Of course.
And people,
yeah,
saying, I want a donation from someone with a hip injury, you know,
right,
which,
right,
which is where I think the caution needs to come in. But is that something that could be explored? Is I feel that I should pray for someone specifically, or are charismatic churches a concern?
Well, I think to err on the side that God does speak and God does live and God is moving interactively with us all day long, I think that we can make some errors in that, but again, it's the point of the community coming around. Are we all seeing the same thing together? Great first question, Logan. It's 19 minutes past the hour. We better take a break. I'm super curious. This is unscripted, so mm-hmm. I have no idea what's coming next. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I am Peter Kapsner and Logan Rausch in studio. We'll be back in just a minute. It's 21 minutes past the hour. It's Faith Radio Mornings, and Logan, good opening first question. Parents and grandparents that are listening, you just need to know, this is a really common question I get among my 18 to 22-year-olds as they're trying to figure out their own journey of faith. What does it mean that God might be speaking to us? How do we not abuse that, but also think about a God who's actively involved? So this new segment, Logan, is called
Super Sunday School.
And we're eventually going to hit the streets with a microphone, you know, kind of do the late show, tonight show kind of thing where we get questions from the streets. But I know you've brought some questions this morning. I don't know what they are. So we've got a few minutes left here. Give us another one.
Yeah, the purpose of this segment is just to ask questions that adults are asking. You know, kids in Sunday school would ask, how do I spell Zacchaeus? Well, we as adults have bigger questions. And Dr. Peter Kapsner has a doctorate in practical theology. And so he seems to have some experience in this.
Making it up as I go along, Logan.
So I do want to ask you now about, I'm a very logical person.
Yeah.
And I'm also a very lazy person.
Okay.
So I tend to find myself trying to do the right thing, but as easily as possible.
Gotcha.
So bear with me on this. And after this, everyone will probably call me a sinner. But boiled down, correct me if I'm wrong, if I really boil it down into the simplest category, if I truly love and accept the message of Jesus Christ in my heart, if I acknowledge that he died for my sins on the cross so that I could eventually be removed from sin and have eternity in heaven, then I essentially got my swiped key card into heaven. Is that a correct statement?
Well, that one is a little bit tricky, Logan, because now you're bringing up the idea of salvation and what salvation actually means in the biblical text. And so the very root of the word salvation means two things. It means to heal and to rescue from. And those two things are always present in any salvation moment, to rescue from and then to make whole. And so there's salvation moments all throughout the Old Testament, like when the Pharaoh and the Egyptians are bearing down on the Israelites at the shores of the Red Sea, and God makes a way through the waters. It's a salvation moment. He has rescued them, and he's going to be bringing them out of slavery into wholeness. And so sometimes we think of salvation as only that which happens after we die. And clearly there is we are rescued from the waters of death in those moments and brought forth into life, into wholeness. But salvation in the biblical text really is, it's what theologians call something that's happening both now and not yet fully realized. And so we taste of salvation. We taste of the rescuing from the power of sin. We can live by a different power in this life. That is also salvation. It's part of why Paul says in Philippians to work out your salvation in fear and trembling, for God is at work in you. That's a terrifying passage for people who are concerned about salvation by works, even some very ultra Lutheran theology that was misunderstood from what Luther was saying, is that salvation is this ongoing process in which we are saved and rescued from the power of sin, even to some degree in this life, while we wait for the fullness of it in the future. It's a beautiful invitation. Otherwise, like you said, hey, I prayed a prayer. God waved maybe a magic wand. I get into heaven when I die. Why don't I just hit somewhere in the middle of Lake Superior with a boat and sing Kumbaya until that moment comes?
Well, I want to expand a little bit on what I said then, because I
think we only have like 2 minutes left.
Yeah, so help me.
Yeah, no, I can plead the fifth.
I totally agree with what you're saying, is that salvation is a process. But I think one thing that we can say as Christians is that your actions would reflect your faith. If you believe this, you're going to live that lifestyle. So let's say that I do. I eventually believe this. I live the lifestyle. I have it in my heart. I have it in my hands. However, and I think a lot of people who hit their 20s or are young go on this spiritual journey where maybe they're fed up with the church, and so they say to themselves, you know what, I'm just going to grow a man bun and travel the world. Maybe I'll end up in China for a while, practice some Buddhism, and then I'll come back, and maybe I'll just join back in with the church when I'm seated and comfortable. I've experienced the world, and now I'm, I don't know, 40 to 50, 60 years old.
Yeah.
And now that's a concern, obviously, but do they then have the same possibility of, well, I didn't believe in God the whole time and I didn't follow the steps, but I can swing back in when I'm 60 and I'll still get my card in, right?
Yeah, you bring up a great point. And I think when we conceive of our Christian faith as a bunch of rules that we need to live by and try really hard to do, and God is maybe some sort of policeman in the sky that's got a check sheet about whether we're breaking the law on that day versus not, it's not the beautiful invitation of the faith. The beautiful invitation of Christianity is that I can bend my knee and humility and acknowledge Jesus as Lord. And when those moments happen, there gets to be a power that can be at work in our life that really changes us from the inside out. So when it says that delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart, this is not the idea that if I pray really hard and I really love God and worship with my hands upraised, that I'm going to get maybe a spouse or a dog or a car or something like that. It really is this humble invitation to say, maybe the things of my heart that I don't currently delight in, God, can you reorder those desires so that I'm living from the inside out? Because as you said, if Christianity, even for our young people, for all of us, is constructed as a rules-based thing that I got to get up and kind of grind through that day, that's going to fail pretty quickly. The invitation really is an ongoing formation from the inside out. It's why Paul says, again, in one of his letters, that we are transformed from one degree of glory to the next as we partner with the Spirit. It comes from the inside out. And so we're not invited to love through gritted teeth our neighbor. We're actually called to love our neighbor. And so last point on that is I think about Jesus hanging on the cross when he said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Did he say those words through gritted teeth thinking, I really can't stand these people that are jabbing me with a spear right now and killing me unjustly, but I got to do the right thing. So gritted teeth, Father, forgive. No, the question is how did Jesus see the world in those moments that in those places coming from the inside out offered forgiveness? That's the very courageous invitation of the Christian faith to walk out the formational journey. Logan, we're out of time.
I know.
Only two questions in. We would love your questions for next week for this segment. We'll hit the street. The questions of our faith that we just don't tend to ask. This, again, is a segment called...
Super Sunday School.
It is 28 minutes past the hour. We'll take a break for Breakpoint and the news, and we'll come back in the last part of our show with Ann Bradley to talk about tariffs and economics. Stay with us. Thirty-three minutes past the hour. Logan, glad to be off the hot seat, but these are the questions that people are asking. I get them over and over and over again in my classes. Thanks for asking the questions you did.
Yeah, happily. And you know, they're only going to get harder. Breakpoint was just discussing the difficulties of sexual identity and the conversations that are being had in Congress. And you know what? We're going to have them here too.
I can already prophetically tell that I'm going to be sick for the next month. So we'll see how this goes. We'll take a break for news and come back with Dr. Ann Bradley. Joe Stowell, president of Cornerstone University, is talking to us this morning about effective leadership.
Good, effective leadership is permitting Jesus to move our instincts, for instance, from bigger is better, right? Moving our instincts to what is correct and right side up according to him and his kingdom, so that in the long term, we may not have done something bigger, but we may have done something far better for Christ and his kingdom, given how we have led, leading from our character and leading according to the ways of Jesus Christ.
I love that from Joe Stowell, just talking even about how our relationship with Jesus can impact and affect our character and even how we perceive the world. If you want to catch that entire segment, head to myfaithradio.com and search for Effective Leadership or Joe Stowell. You can hear all of what he has to say about effective leadership. We'll take a short break and be back with Dr. Ann Bradley to talk about some of the economic scene in our country.
Look back at previous generations and you'll see people who worked hard to meet their basic needs. Fast forward to today's teens and you find almost the exact opposite. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Generally speaking, today's generation of young adults are some of the most entitled and irresponsible people on the planet. They stay immature long into their 20s, they treat people disrespectfully, and they basically refuse to grow up. Well, as long as parents are willing to serve everything up on a silver platter for their kid, they unintentionally postpone the development of their teen. Are you looking to infuse some independence and maturity? Try holding back on a few things and let your children stretch their muscles to fulfill their own desires.
There's much more encouragement for parents from Mark Gregston online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
It is 20 minutes before the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are joined on this Thursday morning, as we often are, by Dr. Ann Bradley to talk about things related to economics and where we are with our capitalism in our country. And Ann, I'm just curious, was there a tariff on your coffee this morning?
Well, if there wasn't, there's going to be soon, or at least we can expect that there might be one soon with the way things are going. So, it's kind of you have to open up the newspaper every day to see what has happened in the last 24 hours with the new kind of obsession with tariffs.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. I would love your comments. We have a real short clip here played from the president about the recent decision of Harley-Davidson to move some of their jobs overseas. Logan, do we have that clip available? Let's
I think the people that ride Harleys are not happy with Harley-Davidson, and I wouldn't be either.
You know, and what sort of is ironic about this whole thing is the president extolled the virtues of Harley-Davidson during the campaign as this model American company. And now he is obviously insulting Harley-Davidson for the decision to move overseas. But my understanding is that the tariff impact is affecting their bottom line by about $100 million annually. So what decisions are they going to make, right? And you've talked passionately the last few programs about what impact tariffs could have in a negative way.
That's right. And, you know, it's so interesting to me that we're having this conversation about Harley-Davidson because they are not new to this kind of situation. If you look back at the 80s, you know, in 1981 and 82, there was a pretty bad economic recession that particularly affected blue-collar workers. And at that time, blue-collar workers were the main consumer base for Harley-Davidson. So Harley-Davidson, back in the 80s, actually petitioned the SEC, as well as President Reagan, for tariff protection because Honda and Kawasaki had opened motorcycle manufacturing plants in the United States. And so, you know, what we see here is that on the one hand, you look back in history and you say, this is a company that has agitated for tariffs before because they want to protect their company. And now they are on the other side of this, which is these tariffs make it very expensive to do business. And so what are they going to do? They're going to have to find another place to do business. And that's bad for everyone. It's, you know, I have to say one thing here. We need to be careful. And I think people on the right tend to have the motto, I'm pro-business. And I don't think there's anything kind of at the surface wrong with that. I think it tends to mean for people, I'm pro-entrepreneurship, I'm pro-family businesses, I want people to be able to be creative, and all those things are good, but what we should really be is pro-consumer, because when we take the line that we're pro-business, then we want to protect the business at all costs or at any cost maybe, right? So that would mean protect Harley-Davidson from international competition or defend Harley-Davidson against foreign competition. And so you don't want to be kind of put in that position where you're taking different political angles because you're pro-business. What we want to be is pro-consumer. And what that means is that we want these things to be better and better levels of quality and lower levels of prices. And tariffs just disrupt markets. They disrupt what the market would normally do. And so now what do we see Harley-Davidson do? They're saying, this is too expensive, these steel and aluminum tariffs. And the EU, well, I mean, of course, the steel and aluminum tariffs came from President Trump. And what is the EU doing? They're responding with retaliatory tariffs, which is what we tend to see all the time in international trade. And so it's kind of a losing proposition. And what you're going to see is these jobs are going to leave the United States, which is presumably what Donald Trump wants to protect against. And so it's kind of what we call in economics an unintended consequence that can be very expensive.
Dr. Ann Bradley with the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, also professors taught at George Mason, Georgetown as well. And Ann, I'd be curious, these days, how easy is it for a company to relocate? You know, again, tariffs maybe are more effective when there wasn't so much globalization and mobilization, but companies can pretty effectively relocate their headquarters to a more tariff-friendly situation.
Yes, I mean, of course, nothing is zero cost, right? Especially when you're talking about things that are made of, you know, steel. You know, they require big manufacturing plants, and so there's a physicality to that type of production that I think does involve a cost. And then there's, of course, incorporation and the law and everything that goes around that. So it's certainly not just free, but it is so much easier, as you say. And I think that's a good thing that it's easier because it means that companies can choose the most business-friendly environment. And again, that's not just, you know, we don't say we want that because we're just out for companies to make profits at all costs, but it's good for consumers. It's really interesting because if you look at kind of the onset of modern globalization, which kind of started in the 90s, and you saw what a lot of American manufacturers, especially in apparel and textiles, were doing, was they were going to new emerging economies, in particular China. You know, China had been a closed economy for a very long time, and then in the early 80s, it changed that. And so this provided an opportunity for American and other apparel makers in particular to go to China and start their plants. Apple has manufacturing plants in China. This allows you to have your smartphones and your iPads at a much lower cost. And so that's what being pro-consumer means. And you're right, open borders, and it's not just open borders, and I don't mean that in a physical way. I just mean the ability for companies to move globally. I think the digital age breaks down trade barriers, and that's a good thing, because when these tariffs happen, the companies don't have to kind of get crushed by the retaliatory tariffs. They can say, okay, we're going to move somewhere else. But, I mean, the question is, do we really want that? Hmm. You know, they were here originally for a reason, and so it's disruptive.
It's great stuff. It's Dr. Ann Bradley. And, Ann, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I would love to get your thoughts about an article that one of your colleagues, Hugh Welchel, has written, and just about the book Kenneth Barnes has written that he was commenting on, called Redeeming Capitalism. And there's such a backlash to some of the ills of capitalism in our society that we're trending towards socialism with the next generation. But maybe there's some ways in which capitalism can be redeemed to really become a more virtuous situation. I would love your thoughts on that. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back. It's 11 minutes before the top of the hour. It's Faith Radio Mornings, and we have Ann Bradley on the line talking about economics. And specifically, Ann, in this one, I would love to get your take on this idea of redeeming capitalism. And let me read a quote from social activist Michael Moore, who is critiquing capitalism. I'll be curious on your thoughts on this. He says that capitalism is a system to guarantee that greed becomes the primary force of all economics. It allows the very few at the top to get very wealthy and has the rest of us riding around thinking we can get wealthy too. It's just work hard enough, sell enough Tupperware and Amway products, and we can get a pink Cadillac. He is not very happy with capitalism. Obviously, income gap has been a big issue in the news over the last few years. What can you say that's a legitimate critique of the current form of capitalism, and how might we begin to redeem it?
It's such a good question, and that's such a powerful quote. And I really think that Michael Moore is tapping into the pulse of, you know, kind of the volatile American political culture. And I also think that something that accompanies this, maybe we can talk about this another time, is that the loss of civility in all of this, so it becomes very difficult to have a real conversation about the pros and cons of capitalism. And so I think where we have to start and where I would start in addressing his real concerns are that we always have to be worried about greed. We've never not, you know, had that concern ever. And it's interesting to hear other people think about this. I'm a fan of the work of Steven Pinker, who is not a Christian at all. And I don't even know if he would qualify himself as a capitalist. He's a sociologist from Harvard, and he writes about the Enlightenment. And, you know, he has this very powerful book. It's called The Better Angels of Our Nature. It came out a few years ago. And he details in this book what has happened over the past 1,000 years of human history. And you can read about, you know, how, you don't have to read the book. You can read summaries online. But so I think the Wall Street Journal titled an essay related to the book called Violence Vanquished. And the whole notion is that, you know, greed has always been there. We used to duel with our rivals, our political rivals. By the way, we did that in the American Republic. We used to behead relatives. British monarchs did that. We used to take our children into the public square and watch executions of different kinds. I mean, when you think about that, and then you think about what Moore's saying, I think we really have to look at the history first off, and I also really have to think we have to look at, well, what is capitalism doing? What are the incentives that it sets up versus, And you always have to ask people who are levying these complaints, which are not all wrong, by the way, is, well, what are the alternatives? If we're not going to live in a capitalist system because he thinks it institutionalizes greed, what are the alternatives? And I really feel that Milton Friedman is very good on this. Milton Friedman would say, you know, every human being has a potential for greed. But the question is, what is the system that mitigates the greed? And I think where Michael Moore and I disagree is not that we don't have concerns and that people under capitalist systems can still behave badly. But I think the difference about a market economy, which is what capitalism is about, is that it is a system that doesn't incentivize greed. And remember what we're saying when we're saying greed. We're saying unmitigated desire, meaning I'm going to steal, lie, cheat, do whatever I can to benefit myself. That's different from self-interest. And so, you know, look at the USSR's experiment with socialism or communism. Look at what's going on today in Venezuela with socialism. Do you think there's no socialism or no greed in Venezuela? In fact, people are rioting in the streets, they're hoarding, they're stealing because they have nothing left to do. There's nothing. You know, the grocery stores are empty. There's no doctors to care for sick patients, so they die. So I really think, you know, socialism and communism have historically proven to, in fact, reward greed. That's the way you get to the top. That's the way you supposedly benefit. In capitalism, I mean, Bill Gates is very wealthy, yes, and he could be greedy as a result of that wealth. His heart could be, you know, not Christ-centered, but that's not because of the money. That's because of his heart. So I think where we get where Michael Moore and I and you would maybe disagree is that this is a human heart issue. And frankly, capitalism can't save our hearts. Jesus can. So I think if we're gonna walk away from our morality, if we're gonna walk away from the biblical understanding of what it means to flourish and what God intended for us here, we're gonna suffer problems, capitalism or not.
It's Dr. Ann Bradley. Great stuff on that. It's interesting timing for all of this in particular, because we obviously saw the nomination of a 28-year-old Latino woman in New York,
yeah,
and Ocasio-Cortez, who is an avowed socialist. And we have this sort of rise of socialism. And you spoke briefly just even about, from a historical standpoint, where socialism maybe hasn't always been the answer either in this. I'd be curious, we just got a minute left or so, can you give us a sense on the downside of socialism if we were to trend that way as a country?
Yeah, you know, so I think what Cortez and others would advocate for is, they're not advocating for pure socialism, you know, the abolishment of private property. At least that's not, you know, in Bernie Sanders, these, I think they use the word socialism wrong. I think they want a more controlled economy, for sure. I think they want more income redistribution. But we can talk about the dangers of that, again, which is, what does it incentivize ordinary human beings to do? Does it incentivize them to start businesses, to give back to their community? I mean, this is the only times we've ever seen this type of behavior in human history is when we have a largely unconstrained market economy. And so to Cortez, what I would say is, in your vision of how you're going to use government to correct human faults, who's going to correct the faults of the humans that are running the government? That has been the question. And even with soft socialism, which is what I think she's peddling, she and others don't have a response to that. They just say, well, if it's about, we got to get the right people in office. And if we get the right benevolent people, it's going to be okay. And history just proves that that's wrong. So I think it's a dangerous track we're on. And one last thing I would say is what I said before. I think the loss of civility, that we can't discuss openly, we can't have debates about capitalism and socialism, I think we're losing ground there. I think that's where you see this 28-year-old upsetting, you know, kind of a standing Democrat. This is very shocking, but I think it's the result of the volatility. And so we need to be good communicators, and we need to lead with empathy.
Great stuff from Dr. Ann Bradley, and agree, the loss of civility, it doesn't allow us to just have a genuine critique of a system that maybe could use some reform. We don't have to just blow up everything. We can work together, right, as a country towards reform. Love your comments. It's going to be a fascinating next 4 or 5 months before the midterms. I hope you stay with us and keep talking us through this.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
Great. Have a great morning. We've got about 3 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up the show.
Well, as we close our Faith Radio Mornings show for the day, Peter, I got to ask, we've talked a lot about Cortez this last 2 hours, but what were you doing when you were 28?
Well, it was not running for office back then, Logan. I think I was trying to make sure that we had enough Lucky Charms on the table at that point, working in a factory, just trying to sort it out. Paul, what were you doing at 28 years old?
I was in Wisconsin.
You were in Wisconsin.
Radio job, yeah.
You were. So, and you were working through, again, just trying to get food on the table.
Just
we're not talking about running
no
for...
No Lucky Charms, though.
Logan, you know, there's 6 years ahead for you. You've got to be able to deconstruct, you know, a public society in the way that Cortez is doing right now. What are you going to do about that?
I don't know. What am I going to do when I'm 28? I guess supposedly I need to get some Lucky Charms and a radio job in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, maybe some Twisted Cheetos out of Fargo, North Dakota. So please send us if you're listening in Fargo. Great morning. Remember, the tomb is empty, and we'll catch you tomorrow morning.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.